Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're going to be in Genesis 6 and 7 today, which deal with the flood account. There are some very controversial points here in the history of interpretation, because the text is somewhat ambiguous on some things we're really curious about. The first one begins quite early on the sons of God and the daughters of men. There's been a real hair pull over that, over does that refer to the line of Seth marrying the line of Cain, or does it refer to the angels marrying human women? I want to take a brief time at the beginning of this show to kind of go through why commentators, godly commentators, on both sides have disagreed on this. First of all, let's look at the reason why it might be the line of Seth marrying the line of Cain. The larger context of chapters 4 and 5 talk about the development of two different kinds of people. Obviously, chapter 4 is the fallen line of Cain, and chapter 5 is the more godly line of Seth. And so it seems to fit that we're talking about the mixing of these two that had been so distinct in 4 and 5, and I can certainly understand that. Others have asserted, though, that what we have is a supernatural element coming in that we're showing another kind of evil. We've seen how men have intensified in evil. Now we're going to see another supernatural kind of evil, not temptation, but the mixing of races. Now that seems to be true because of the giants came out of this relationship because of some of the peculiarities in the syntax, the verses 1 through 4. It has been a traditional interpretation, though even with the rabbi, their rabbis have been two different groups. One saw it angels, one saw it the line of Seth being corrupted. I must admit, I tend to think we're talking about angels for these reasons. It's an ancient tradition. It seems to be alluded to in Jude chapter 6, picked up on in 2 Peter 2, 4 through 6. The early church was influenced greatly by a little book called Enoch. And Enoch says that the reason the flood came is because God wanted to wipe out this mixed race of human and angels. And so I really think that seems to fit the New Testament evidence better. So let me go back through here and see if I can give you some insight into this. Now, it came about that when men began to multiply on the face of the land, the daughters were born to them. It doesn't imply they didn't have daughters before, but they were having more daughters. And it came at the sons of God. Now, Enoch and we learn from the Qumran literature, the Genesis Apocryphon, both think it's angels. Now, the term sons of God refers to angels most often. We see that in Job 1:6, Job 2:1, Job 38:7, Daniel 3:25, Psalms 29:1, and Psalms 89:6 and 7. Now, the phrase in its similar form, meaning children, is often used of human beings. We see that in Psalm 73:15, we see it in Deuteronomy 32:5, and we see it in Hosea chapter 1, verse 10. So it's not always angels, but it is most often. You say, well, why would angels want to take women? Well, the book of Jubilees, which is mentioned in this very good book on Judaism by Moore, volumes 1 and 2, particularly in volume 2 here on page 315 mentions, and the book of Jubilees, it says the angels came to teach men about civilization. But as they were teaching them, the beauty of the human women lured them, and they fell through their lust. Now you say, well, but in Matthew, let's see, 22:30, it says that angels aren't sexual beings. Well, the angels we're talking about here, I think, are the angels of Jude 6 that are into Taurus. They're in chains. They were a different kind of angel. We know that angels came in human form quite often. So I think one group of angels had sexual possibilities, and either God stopped that at this point for all angels, or this was a special group. So I don't think it's necessarily the Matthew passage completely removes the possibility of angels here. Well, why else would angels want to come? Well, those books that, like Unger's Demons in the World Today, or Montgomery's Principalities and Powers, Jack Taylor Dealing with the Devil, books on the occult like that say that they came to teach man occultic knowledge, that was part of the knowledge of good and evil that man had, and they came to develop it so that humans and angels could oppose God and try to manipulate creation toward their will. Others say that they tried to give immortality to man by mixing the seed of angels with the seed of men, and that they're trying to thwart God's will, and that may be true. Others say it's a way to pollute the messianic line of Seth with angels, which would foul up God's plan for redeeming man. Now, if any of those are true, or a little bit of all of those are true, I simply don't know. We don't have enough information. Now it says the daughters of men, that's usually, of course, a way of referring to human women, were beautiful. So obviously lust is a problem here. Now whether it's of Seth's line or of angels, we can't be dogmatic, but there's a sexual problem developing here. And they took wives for themselves. This means marriage. Now, that's why some say it can't be angels, because they didn't certainly marry women. But we don't know that they didn't come and make their settled abode here. But it means marriage. And whomever they chose, seemingly they could take who they wanted to. Married women, unmarried women. That seemed to fit more of angels coming and capturing women than it does Seth's line coming and just taking Canaanite women. Now, I really believe there is probably an ancient origin to most of the myths that we have. I'm not saying this is myth. I'm saying like the Roman and Greek pantheons where gods marry women. I really think there's something here, the fact there was an ancient core of truth that has been perverted in most of the human traditions except the Bible. Now, the two books, the Babylonian Genesis and the Gilgamesh epic, tell us about the ancient Sumerian, Babylonian, Assyrian creation account. And it is very similar to the creation account in the Bible, including a universal flood. So therefore, I really think that what we have is a truth, a part of a truth, captured in some of these cultural myths that go back to what really happened that's recorded in the Bible. You can buy that or not. I don't know if you will or not. Verse 3. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not always strive with man forever, because he is but flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. Now, that's very difficult, and part of the problem interpreting comes from this. My spirit, the word spirit means ruah, wind, breath, that kind of thing. My spirit will not always, now the word strive is a possibility, remains a possibility with man forever, because he is but flesh. Now, today's English version seems to imply that he is mortal. And if that is true, it lends itself, part of the interpretation, that we're talking about angels trying to give man immortality, and God said, no, we're not going to do that. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. Now, some say this means that God's giving him a time of grace to repent. Noah is going to be a preacher of righteousness, we learn from 2 Peter 2:5. And so it's kind of a grace period to see if man will turn back from his evil, his occultic praxis, his sexual urge, his mixing with the angels, whatever. Others say, no, it refers to the fact this is going to be man's life span after the flood. But, of course, we have an account of man living longer than this. The 120 years has caused people a problem because Noah's 500 when God starts dealing with him. And the flood comes when he's 600, and that's only 100 years. So the rabbis say that God came 20 years earlier, but the Bible's out of chronological order. Now, how to solve it, I'm not real sure. And the Nephilim, now this seems to be a Hebrew word from the fallen ones, is translated by many ancient ones, the giants. You see that in the Septuagint, you see it in the Vulgate, Numbers 13:33 seems to add to that. Now, those who disagree with this being angels here make this term mean the tyrants. That'd be Martin Luther and a modern commentator I like so much, Loophole, make it ruffians, tyrants, bullies, that kind of thing. But Nephilim seems to be connected with the Raphim, which would be the giants. And so I think this is one evidence that we are talking about, that a very powerful group of human beings came from the union of angels and women. Now, it says, we're on the earth in those days. Those who don't believe it was angels say, see, they were already on the earth before these two groups came together. Others say it implies that these giants came out of the union, and I'm not sure from the Hebrew which it is. So also afterward, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, and they were mighty men of old, men of renown. Now, some say the mighty is the idea of semi-supernatural, very powerful, very evil, and that these are the ones that tore up the earth. Now, the book of Enoch that I showed you really seems to give that interpretation. Enoch even says that God brought the flood not only because of the evil of man, but because the mixing of the angelic order and the human order really fouled things up. We get that from Enoch chapter 7, chapter 15, and chapter 86. And you might want to look that up and see what you believe about that. Verses 5 and verse 11 and 12 and one phrase in verse 13 really talks about the depth of the corruption that had occurred in the human race. God, it's so different from 131 where God said everything was good. Now, in essence, He's saying everything is totally bad. Mankind has totally polluted himself. The wickedness of man was great on the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was on evil continually. You might want to see chapter 8, verse 21, where the same phrase is used in Psalms 14:3. And the Lord was sorry that He had made man on the earth, and He grieved him in his heart. The word means grieved into his heart. Really a strong word. The word sorry means to heave a sigh. It's almost the word repented. Now here, of course, this anthropomorphic, we're talking about God as if He had human emotions. The idea that God repented or sorrowed that He had done something is quite common in the Bible. Exodus 32:14, Jeremiah 18:7-8, Jeremiah 26:13-19, Jonah 3:10, 1 Samuel 15:11. Now, it's denied that God repents in Numbers 23:19 and 1 Samuel 15:29. So it's not that guy that God is capricious, but it's putting human emotions on God that He's sorry man was going this way, man was doing this thing, and God was going to have to alter what He wanted to do because of the evil of man. That seems to be the backup here. Notice it says in verse 7, He's going to blot out man. This is to wash away. It's kind of a pun on the idea of a flood. I was sorry that I made them. The idea of all creation fell here. The animals were affected. I don't know if the bestiality was involved here, but it's quite probable because of the sexual overtones here. Whatever, it was total corruption. Verse 8. And Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Here's another anthropomorphic phrase. God doesn't have eyes. It means God saw that Noah was a godly man in his generation. And these are the records of the generation of Noah. Noah means rest. And he was a righteous man, blameless in his time. The word righteous means he conformed to the standard of what he understood God's will to be. The word righteous means a measuring reed. And the word blameless means complete. It's used of sacrificial animals, not having a defect. Here it means not he was sinless, but that he had integrity or wholeness of heart toward God. And he walked with God. Now, this is an emphasis here because with God is first in the sentence. It's a stronger form than even Enoch back in chapter 5, verses 21 through 24. And Noah became the father of three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Same as chapter 5, verse 32. Now, verse 11 and 12 are the same intensity of the corruption of mankind. Then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me. It's come into my mind what I'm going to do. I'm going to destroy mankind along with the animals, not the fish, but the animals that breathe." And the earth was filled with violence. Some say because of these mighty half-giants. Others say because of the lust of men and killing each other, farming, robbing. I'm not sure what it means. We can't be certain. Make for yourself an ark. This seems to be an Egyptian loan word. It means coffin or chest or box. It wasn't a ship because it wasn't navigable. It meant just to float. You can see the same word in Exodus 2, 3, and 4 about the basket that the child Moses was put in. Of gopher wood. We have no idea what this means. It seems to be a certain shape as it's translated in the Septuagint. It seems to be a type of wood, many scholars say, possibly cypress. Some say from the Vulgate it means smooth wood, but we just can't be certain. We don't know. You shall make an ark with rooms, and you shall cover it inside and out with pitch. The same root for pitch means to cover. We get the word kippur from. It seems to mean it was a way of water sealing this already very resinous type wood. And this is how you shall make it. And it gives the length, 300 cubits, breadth, 50. Now, a cubit is distance from man's longest finger to his elbow. Now, there's a longer cubit in building we find in Egypt, which is 21. Let's assume it's 18 inches. The size of this ship would be 450 feet by 75 feet by 45 feet. A large ship, about half the size of the Queen Elizabeth. Now, notice it mentions in verse 16 about a window. You shall make a window for the ark. Now, this word window has been greatly disputed. It means roof, and some think it means that. But most feel like is a different term for the word window used in chapter 8, verse 6. This is probably an opening around the top of the ark where the roof overlapped it for air and light, because it had been really stuffy with all those animals in there. So maybe it's a window or an opening for ventilation and light around the top, close to the roof, is what I really think it is. Verse 17, behold, I am going to bring the flood. Now, the flood may be from an Assyrian word to destroy. We're just not sure. I wish I had time to talk about all the theories. There are two basic: a universal flood that's captured in the memories of many peoples around the world, and a local flood. Now, the biblical text seems to require a universal flood, that maybe the landmass fell, or the mountains weren't as high as they are today. But it's not that you're a heretic if you believe in a local flood. This is somebody I trust very much. It's Bernard Ram, the Christian view of science and scripture, and he argues for a limited flood. But another very good book is a book, The Genesis Flood, by Whitcomb and Morris, and they argue very persuasively for a universal flood, and they are very technical. So if you're interested in a technical discussion of the flood and the geological formations that resulted in all, I hope you'll get this, The Genesis Flood, by Whitcomb and Morris. Now, notice it says, to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life. And the breath of life, ruah, same word as spirit. Remember how God put the breath of life both in animals and in man. This is not the idea of he breathing the man the breath of life. That's man's uniqueness. But the breath is in all animals. And I will establish my covenant, verse 18. First time that term's been used, it'll be explained in chapter 9, verses 8 through 17. And look at verse 19. And every living thing of flesh you shall bring. But look at last part of verse 20. They shall come to you. The animals came to Noah, and apparently he put them in the ark where he wanted. There were three levels. Maybe the carnivorous animals were on one level and the other animals on the other. We don't know exactly. Maybe the bottom level was for excretions and food stored up. We just don't know. There were three levels. Some say the word rooms doesn't mean divided by wood, but divided by reeds. We just don't have any idea at all about the construction of the internal aspect of the ark, except the limited amount of knowledge we have here. It said Noah did all this. And then in chapter 7, the Lord said to Noah. There's been a lot of discussion about that there's a J document and an E document, meaning Yahweh and Elohim. But if you'll notice, Yahweh talks to Noah in verse 1, and Elohim talks to Noah in verse 16. And higher criticism has really had to try to jump back and forth to try to explain this. I really reject the JEDP theory. I think Josh McDowell's books, Evidence, More Evidence That Demands a Verdict, Volume 2, on this is very helpful, and I think you ought to get it. Now, that's where it says, enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me. Notice the righteousness of Noah, the benefits of that were passed on to his wife and his kids and their wives. They did not have the level of righteousness Noah did. Now, I don't believe in the merits of the saints, a Roman Catholic view, but I want to say there's an element of truth there. For even in the New Testament, we see that if a believer is married to an unbeliever, that the believing spouse somehow sanctifies the kids, meaning that their relationship with God is somehow passed on to the children in the sense of their lifestyle, their instructions, their godliness. And that's true here. It's a sense of corporality, where one man's, remember, it's the idea of sin affects the whole group and righteousness can affect a group. And that's the idea that's here. Now, notice where it continues then. And you shall take for yourself clean animals. Now you say, well, how does he know who's clean and unclean? Well, some commentators say, well, it's obvious that a lamb is clean and a hyena is unclean and a dove is clean and a vulture is unclean. It's just a common thing. Maybe that's true as a common kind of view there. Most say, the rabbis say that Noah had a copy of the Torah and he read it and found out. Well, I think that's a rabbinical speculation. They say the Torah was pre-existent. And I think that just is a bias they have that's non-exegetical. Really, I think this must be connected somehow with sacrifice that started back in the time of Cain and Abel, and is not fully developed until the Mosaic Law. Many parts of the Mosaic Law took that which was common in the culture and put new significance on it, and so I think that's probably what's happening here. Now, it says seven pairs. Some think it means seven twos, and others think it means seven individual animal, three pairs. Now, the ones who think it's seven pairs are the Septuagint, the Vulgate, and Ibn Ezra. Those who think it's seven animals are Chrysostom, Augustine, Theodoret, Calvin, Kyle, and Delitzsch. Now, which it is, I don't know. Some say it's three pairs with an extra one for sacrifice. I just don't know. and the birds of the sky, seven pairs, male and female, to keep the offspring alive on the face of the earth. So after seven more days, now the rabbis say this seven more days is mourning for Methuselah. For they say the flood didn't come until a week after Methuselah died because God respected Methuselah's righteousness. Again, that's a rabbinic legend that we simply cannot back up. We don't know why the 7 days, except God was giving Noah last-minute preparation, saying, fella, it's coming in a week. You get ready. Make everything ready. This doesn't mean he loaded all the animals in 7 days. Many of them may have already been loaded and just the final implements done. We just can't read too much in here now. And it began to rain 40 days and 40 nights. Now, 40 is a number that appears in the Bible over and over. There's a good little book out called Biblical Numerology you might want to get that shows the meaning of different terms, numbers in the Bible. I think the word 40 means a long period of indefinite time. Now, there are some places where it means 40 right on the money, but most times it means just a long period because it sure didn't have calendar quartz watches then. Now notice it says every living thing that I made. Well, that doesn't include aquatic life because apparently they were not killed in the flood. Now Noah was 600 years old when the flood came. Now if you go back to the last chapter, he was 500 when God spoke to him. It's only been 100 years. What happened to the other 20? Well, the rabbis say he spoke 20 years before Ham, Japheth, and Shem were born, and he simply fulfilled it after his sons could help him. I don't know what I believe about that. Now, verse 11 gives the exact dating. And the dating is very, very specific. It mentions the second month, the 17th day. Boy, this is trying to date it. This is acting like it is a very historical event. This is not some mythological character. Now, I agree it has some connections with these ancient Near Eastern myth, but it's so very different that the differentness is greater than the similarity. I believe they go back to one historical core that has been perverted since the Tower of Babel when men were split by God. But whatever, here's a very specific date. This says, the fountains of the great deep were opened, the floodgates of the sky were opened. Now apparently it began to rain profusely, and the underwater caverns were broke up. Now I don't know if the continents fell, for at one time water covered the whole earth. That it seems to be that we're reverting back to that pre-creation, where God's going to start over except for this one righteous man and his family and the few animals that he'd already created. Notice God uses natural means. He doesn't recreate again. He uses natural means to preserve his already finished creation. How many animals there were, if there's as many as there are today, how the animals got to different parts of the world, all of these are questions we cannot answer because we have limited knowledge. I personally believe that the continents fell, and I feel more comfortable with a universal flood, because in all cultures, even American Indian cultures, is an account of an ancient flood. So I personally believe that, but I sure like Bernard Ram and his understanding. I hope you'll get the little book, Christian View of Science and Scripture. It's very helpful. He has a Ph.D. in the philosophy of science and a Ph.D. in theology, a unique combination to cut through some of the junk that's going around in our day. And the rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. I like Bill Cosby's record on this, where he says, I'm going to let it rain. He says, why don't you let it rain? God said, I'm going to let it rain 3 months. And Bill Cosby says, why not 40 days and 40 nights? Let the sewers back up. Well, there's some humorous things here. You almost see Noah with all those animals and all that mess and all that squeaking and honking and barking and chirping. I don't know how the old boy didn't go physically berserk staying with those animals for about a year. But anyway, we don't know all that. We can imagine and think, but we're just not sure. On the same day, Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, Noah's wife, he was monogamous, so was his children, and three wives of his sons entered the ark. Now, some say because they're mentioned different here, the rabbis say that means they could not live together as man and wife while they're in the ark. Men lived over here, women over here. But again, that's that rabbinical bias against sex, which I think is totally inappropriate and certainly not biblical. There was a sexual corruption here, but the Bible never makes sex negative. Okay? Let's see. Let me go down to verse 16. The Lord, notice the covenant term, Yahweh, closed the door. I think it's significant that God did that. Apparently they put pitch in it, so on the inside, and God closed it. It was very, very heavy. It was a way of showing His grace and love. It was also a way, the rabbis say, that God closed the door to keep the other folks out who wanted in once it started raining. The rabbis even say He put lions and bears around the ark so their beating on it wouldn't break the ship. Well, I think, again, that's just wild speculation. I'm sure Noah, being a godly man, would have tried to save the people if he could have. And obviously they were banging on the outside of the boat, screaming. And Noah couldn't get to them. And God had finally come in judgment. He gave them time to respond. They did not. Noah apparently preached those 120 years, 2 Peter 2:5. Nothing happened. It talked about the water. The Hebrew terms here are very strong. I'm sure that much of the geological formations we see can be explained by a universal flood. And I think you ought to see Whitcomb and Morris. They don't have the biases of geologists. They come from a different area, scientific area, but a different area, and they're able to bring some insight, I think, because they're not captured by the modern theories. That's a very good book. I hope you'll get it on this area. So the rest of the chapter just goes on to talk about that God did that and how many cubits it rifted above the mountains. Blood out every living thing upon the face of the ground, animals, creeping things. Noah was left in the ark. Now, we can't spiritualize the ark too much and say it's a type of the church, and I think that's reading way too much here. It may be an analogy, but it's certainly not meant to be taught. Here is a righteous man in the midst of a polluted moral culture. Whether it's polluted by angels, which I personally think, based on New Testament exegesis, and I have a tape called Angels Marrying Women that's based basically on 2 Peter and Jude. If you want to send for that, you can hear my full discussion and theology of that. Whether it's angels messing up the human race, or whether it's the evilness of man in the line of Cain, perverting the line of Seth, mankind has become corrupted. But we see the love of God still, the grace of God that's willing to work with man in the fact that he's going to deal with Noah. I believe in the unity of the human race, not only in a literal ancestor, Adam and Eve, but also through Noah. And so I believe that the different colors are simply brothers and sisters. I think that's a theological statement, a biblical statement, and we need to hear that, because I think in the chapters to come, we're going to be dealing with how all the different races came out of these three sons and out of the dispersion of the Tower of Babel in chapter 10. Please look at these books that I've mentioned to you, the book of Enoch, the Genesis creation account, the Gilgamesh epic, Science and the Scriptures by Bernard Ram, and the Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. These will be very helpful as you struggle through this. There are a million interpretations. Even men that you normally trust really get pretty wild on this. Take what it says. Don't read too much in it. And be careful not to leave out the significant points, but be very careful not to read your bias, your denomination, your systematic theology back into these very brief ancient accounts. Genesis is moving very rapidly through to get to Abraham. It's hitting some high points. They're true. They're not exhaustive. And so don't get all caught up in these early accounts. But without them, we wouldn't understand how God's dealing with us today. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.